Last week, U.S. and NATO forces began the largest U.S. escalation of troops in Afghanistan since the invasion in 2001. 15,000 U.S., NATO, and Afghan troops were unleashed on the city of Marja in the Helmand province in Afghanistan. This was part of a new, two-pronged counterinsurgency strategy to get rid of the Taliban, a strategy that consists of negotiating with certain factions within the Taliban and, on the other hand, using military force to eliminate them. How are women in Afghanistan responding to this attack, and how are women going to be impacted by the so-called reintegration of the Taliban into Afghan politics and the U.S. military escalation in that country? Malihi Razazan spoke with Orzala Ashraf Namat, a prominent Afghan women's rights activist who has devoted 10 years to establishing and delivering training programs to Afghan women and children in refugee communities in Pakistan and Afghanistan, often putting herself directly at risk under the Taliban regime. Orzala started by describing the dire situation in Helmand province.
It's since some days that the international forces, as well as the Afghan government, also started to support this very big operation, basically to get rid of the Taliban from the local communities at Marja and Nodali. These are two districts of Helmand province, which is located in the southern Afghanistan. And what's basically happening is that because of this very wide range of threatenings and warnings that actually has gone through the people who are living there, quite a significant number of people decided to leave the area. And what we are hearing from the people in general is basically the fact that they can't leave in bigger groups. So there are like two, three people basically that are leaving one by one, or two, three in groups of two, three. And the biggest challenge has been for particularly women and children, because an individual man can easily take himself out of the area, while women and children, if they are getting out of the villages, simply the Taliban can discover that they are basically one of those who want to leave the area, and they are kept forced to be to stay in there, and they're probably supposedly going to be used as human shields, what the military is calling it. Well, the situation is quite scary at the moment. A large effort is in place to basically demine the place, because the place was totally mined by the Taliban. The major concern is, of course, the civilian casualties that I personally fear very much that it will be very high. I see it as a show, basically a show, a sort of military operation to show to the people that they are militarily active and they are doing some very big operations. But to put it in a very easy and simple way, the main victim of this show would be the ordinary people, I think.
So, as you said, the main victims are going to be ordinary people, especially women and children. Are there any plans to help these refugees? Because there are hundreds of thousands of refugees, most of them women and children, spread around Afghanistan in camps.
Mm-hmm. You see, when there is an area which is totally blocked by the military forces or operational forces on the ground, they basically do not allow to any of the NGOs or civil society organizations to go there and have activities out there. Unfortunately, because of the security problems and challenges faced by the Afghan civil society activists and Afghan civil society organizations, they have had huge limitations to basically get access to those areas which are considered unsafe by the Afghan government and also by the international or national NGO security regulations. So that also makes it very, very difficult. All what I hear is that ICRC at Kandahar, which is the closest by and also the center of capital Lashkargah, and some other humanitarian organizations are active, and they are ready in terms of receiving potential or possible injured people or those people who will be in need of medical assistance. However, on the humanitarian side and on the refugee side, very little attention has been given to these people so far that I know. As an example, I can tell you that there is a couple of thousands, probably a little bit more, of people who are living in families who have migrated from the operations earlier last year, for example. And those people are living in a very harsh condition in Kabul, with very, very limited and occasional assistance by some certain organizations like UNHCR and so on. So when I see, and when everyone else be the situation of these refugees of the military operations, then it is very difficult to say that a lot of preparation is in place, because these are the older refugees with very unknown destiny. And how can it be possible to see the new refugees having any better lives than this one?
So you are a woman rights activist living in Kabul. What is the scope of your activity when it comes to really assisting, helping, and advocating for the rights of women and girls in Afghanistan?
Well, the rights of women and girls in Afghanistan, in my opinion, and the way I focus my advocacy on is basically to influence the policies to have some major decisions there. For example, in this particular case of a military operation in a certain area, the voices from the Afghan human rights activists or from the Afghan civil society activists and leaders is basically to consider the rights, the humanitarian, international and national norms and standards. This is something that somehow we are in a worse situation than many, many centuries ago, where there was very clear who is fighting against who. And there were no civilians and ordinary people in place, even if you look into the historical background of wars, when wars were happening. So that's one of the key issues that we would basically lobby at the policy level and raise our voices, saying that they have to consider and respect, both sides of both parties have to respect these humanitarian principles. And secondly, it's of course, in terms of the military itself, whether is this the solution to kill them off or to get rid of them? Where would they go if you get rid of them from Nadali? Maybe they will go to Lashkargah. If you go and do an operation in Lashkargah, they will come back to Nadali. So we personally demand other solutions rather than basically military clearance from such a problem that we are facing with. So that's another issue. Coming back to specifically refugee lives, I as a person, and also the linkages and organizations that I know who are ready to support, I have been calling them and contacting them to make sure that they can reach to these people who are in very, very high need to help them as refugees.
Billions of dollars has been poured into Afghanistan through United States government and quote-unquote international communities. When it comes to women's issues, how has this money been spent?
Well, there are a number of issues that I would like to point out here. One, if we look into the situation of Afghan people or the situation of Afghan women in particular, now in comparison to 10 years ago, I think there are such things that we can simply not forget or ignore. And these are some sort of progress that the Afghan women have made due to the current political processes. For example, having a quota system to secure seats in the parliament.
Which is 25%.
Yes, it is 25%. So from each province, basically, we have possibility of having at least 2 seats per province from each of the provinces. We got 34 provinces, but it's around 68 people, 25% of the entire parliamentarians. These are like some of the means that we manage or we consider as our achievement of the last year's struggles that we had as women's rights leaders. On the other side, when it comes to the billions of dollars arriving to Afghanistan, I with very confidence can say that unfortunately, it's a great failure from both sides. It's a great failure from our side as Afghans, and in particular from our government side as an Afghan government, for not being able to put together a proper and comprehensive mechanism of transparency and accountability. And it's also the fault and the failure of the international community, be it the United States or be it any other country, who also did not keep their own partners or their own contractors in a true, transparent and clear, in an accountable way, sort of accountable. And so as a result of this, we are now in a situation that, yes, I definitely agree. If you have a project of $100,000 to do something with, believe that when it reached to the real needy people, probably 20 to 25% of that would probably go to the actual needy people. The rest of it will be charged with high sort of salary of the officers. It will be charged with the contractor and subcontractor and 3 times more subcontractors. and unfortunately it does not reach the people. But having said that, this has been a great challenge that at least I was expecting that the international community in the very recent London conference would identify as their top priority, but unfortunately it didn't make it to the top priority.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about the London conference. The new proposed policy by President Karzai, which has also been endorsed by General Stanley McChrystal, the top commander of U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan. President Karzai said that those Taliban who are not part of the terrorist network, who are the sons of the Afghan soil, and who are in thousands and thousands, they have to be reintegrated, and they are welcomed to be integrated.
Well, first of all, this policy that has been put together by the government and agreed by their counterparts at the United States, this is an issue that we are very, very concerned about. This is a very serious national matter, and unfortunately, I have to highlight the fact that such a program has not gone through an extensive consultation with the ordinary Afghan people whose life will be directly affected by these decisions at the policy level. So Afghan civil society organizations and many other local institutions have not been, or ordinary local, very, very local, like village level or community level institutions have never been consulted on this. Secondly, my worry is even more serious when I find myself out in London, sitting there and hearing that basically the entire international community, without even questioning who are the Taliban, how can we define the Taliban, what type of group they are they a one group, are they a party, what type of structures do they have?
Ashraf, I read in Guardian of London a couple of days ago that Karzai has implemented the controversial law, which was shelved for almost 2 years since it was passed by a slim parliamentary majority in 2007, to give amnesty not just to those quote-unquote, you know, low-level fighters who put down their arms, but also to warlords and people who have killed Afghan citizens.
We just were shocked hearing that actually the amnesty seal at that time has now also become a law. This is basically to support this culture of impunity and to promote this culture of impunity, because Mr. Karzai, just before he became president for the second time, his sort of vision was forget the past and think about future. I mean, we have been experiencing this for the last 8 years, and every day our situation is getting even worse. Just why? Because we forget the past and we don't just think about the future. I think this impunity law, if better we call it, and that is very, very major bit of concern for us. And we are hoping to get more clarification from the government on this, on what basis the Taliban have been also included on this. And simply, I mean, justice is key. I have been saying this and I'm emphasizing about it again. If we don't have a proper and strong justice mechanism in place, we can't reach any security. Now the world has pledged like around $120 billion, if I'm not wrong, to fund this reintegration blanket project, I would call it. I mean, if there is a five times more of these $120 billion, where would it go? You tell me. If we are agreeing that there is corruption, the systems are not clear and transparent, nor for the international level, nor neither in the national level, how can we make sure that it will be used properly in order to really integrate? Who is reintegrating who? I really don't know this, because I'm reading in the news that there is this eastern province Chinwar tribe who have been quote-unquote reintegrated. By the way, let me tell you that there is no Taliban in that Chinwar area. These are basically drug lords. Are we reintegrating the drug lords, making sure that they produce more drugs? So, I mean, the situation to me is seriously concerned. I'm not sure how much of it I can openly speak about, but we are really hoping that the people of United States, those who are very seriously able to keep their own government and policymakers accountable. My demand from all of you is not to simply accept because you like President Obama or you like some specific figures in the higher level. Just don't believe them and just make sure that your own tax money, your own sons and daughters are not killed for a kind of unknown cause. Make sure you know what's happening in this world, and make sure you know who, what is affecting our lives, because we also deserve to live in our country and in the way we have been doing so for the last thousands of years.
And Ashraf, can you talk a little bit about yourself, what you did during the Taliban era, because you were very much involved with education of women and girls back then?
Yes, I was a refugee myself. I was born in Afghanistan, and I was forced to leave Afghanistan, in particular Kabul, where I was living, because of the start of the civil war in the country, and particularly in the city of Kabul. I was forced to leave with my family to Pakistan. So I lived basically 14 years in Pakistan as a war refugee. It was there when I learned about the suffering of my people through my very own personal experiences living in a refugee camp, no access to water, in very basic needs and facilities. And as a result of these experiences, I have started to work as a guide and translator to some aid workers. And that, in particular, my first trip after 10 years back to Afghanistan, back to my homeland in my city, where I was born in 98, has brought this idea to me that I have to start helping out Afghan girls and Afghan women's education. As a result of that, in 99, I founded an organization called Humanitarian Assistance for Women and Children of Afghanistan. We were a group of dedicated youth who were ready to take any risk, but to make sure that at least a number of Afghan women and girls are not deprived of education and they are provided with home-based underground classes to learn how to read and write. This started from a few classes, and it has ended up by the end of the Taliban regime or fall of Taliban regime, it ended up becoming a very strong network of several home-based literacy classes in 5-6 provinces of Afghanistan. So that's how I started basically my work as an activist, and in particular as someone who was leading these underground literacy classes inside Afghanistan. Since 2002, I am based back in Kabul city, and I have been involved in different levels of civil society advocacy, starting from basically on the Afghan constitution and continuing with law, legal reform in defense of women, women's political participation, and also protection of those who are victims of violence against women. So my very recent work after those classes under the Taliban were establishment of a safe house for those women who were at risk of violence. Also founded one of the first safe houses in Afghanistan, which is based in Kabul, but it receives women from all over the country. I have not only created a physical center, which is located in Kabul, but I have been part of an extensive effort jointly with by my other colleagues to create a mechanism that if a woman in, for example, Kandahar needs a strong protection and cannot be protected in Kandahar, she could be safely and securely transferred to Kabul. And we have created partnerships with Afghan government authorities in the much higher level, I would say, in the ministry level. There are contacts with Afghan organizations partner with basically with the Ministry of Women's Affairs. Mm-hmm. And they are the ones who will transfer women who are at risk to us back in the capital in Kabul.
So what happens to these women once they get into these safe houses?
They are provided with several services from education to skill training and psychosocial counseling. They are also provided with legal support if they are in need of proper legal support to go to the court and have access to defense lawyers and legal advisors. They are having it all together. It's culturally sensitive, and at the same time, despite challenges that we have for the security and safety, and we can't really share more details, but they have been very, very highly respected by those women who have accessed and those who are aware of its existence.
One of the troubling news out of Afghanistan has been women setting themselves on fire. Especially I've been reading about Herat province, and the statistic is alarming and on the rise, actually. I think there was like one woman a day. Why do women choose to harm themselves in such a way and many instances die?
Well, this is actually something that probably is more common in one part than the other, and it is to do with the women who have experienced or find some similar experiences in other countries. So, in other words, it has been said that probably because many of people who are closer to Herat province, many of these women have been in the past refugees in Iran, and they have seen that this was one of the means used by women in Iran probably to self-immolate themselves.
In Iran, we have had instances of this happening in the Kurdish areas.
Right. I think it's clearly when you see, when you find yourself in a, such a crisis where you find yourself absolutely helpless, there's no service or mechanism to support you. There's no proper access to justice. The justice system doesn't work. And there's no any other hope. When the hope possibility reaches to that zero, then you got no way but to just basically show your protest. But I think it's not only to die silently. They could choose many, many other means of committing suicide. But I think I personally see immolation or self-immolation or self-burning as a phenomenon that basically shows the resistance of these women until they die. Just giving everyone in the society a very, very strong and powerful message that you can't simply ignore me. Because if they, for example, eat something like a poison, they can be buried silently without any noise, without any shouts, without any neighbor noticing what happened to this woman in this house. But if you choose to self-immolate, I think it is giving a message to the community. And it has been something that, of course, it's very, very sad and it's very shocking for us as those who are basically in my previous job. I have helped many of these women who have burned themselves, and luckily they survived, and they had huge injuries for years. They are under treatment. Some of them, I still know them still. They are under treatment and plastic surgeries. But the fact, the other fact on this side is that they basically send out a message for many other women who are under similar situation, and it threatens their family members that this shame will also come to your house if you don't treat your wife and your mother or your sisters in a proper way. So I personally have this kind of reading of this self-immolation. Why it happens? It happens because there is violence against women. Why violence against women is spread? First of all, it's not a phenomenon only related to Afghanistan,
but it's
a phenomenon closely related to violence, to the history of violence that we have, and it is also related to the poverty that we are living with. So these are sort of combination of all these factors that results into a woman choosing basically self-burning or immolation. And I see it as a message, basically. I think it's a very powerful message that they want to give, these women want to give basically to other women and to other families. And look, if you don't treat me well, that's what I can do, and I put a shame on your family.
I was reading something from a prominent feminist scholar, Denise Candioti, and I just wanted to get your response to it. She says that those of us who work on gender issues routinely lament their marginality to discussion of the global economy, conflict, and policy. In Afghanistan, by contrast, I found myself in a context where there was an abundance, even an excess, of analysis and commentary, descending at times into gender chatter. The issue of Afghan women during 2001 invasion and prior to that was a cause célèbre for many, many, many feminists in the Western countries.
Let me tell you, as an Afghan, how do I see this? As an Afghan and as an Afghan woman, how do I see this situation? I personally believe that we neither have been liberated by any kind of military and non-military force, nor we can be liberated by these forces, even if they stay here forever. 1,000 or 100,000 years. Every country, show one country in the world where an outsider force have managed to dramatically or transform the sort of gender relations in that country, in that society. Mm. If it has been transformed in the UK or the United States, I'm sure there was some sort of grassroots movement who had a huge impact in their own daily life changes. So that's how I believe. I thank and I appreciate the support that some organizations and some of the states and governments have provided to the Afghan people. But this was not because of rescuing the Afghan women. I don't think the international community, under the leadership of the United States, came to Afghanistan to save us. they came to save themselves because there was 9/11 happened. Otherwise, Taliban were in power back in 94, 95. Since 96, they were basically ruling the country. But there was nothing until 9/11 happened. So we were very conscious that what happened in Afghanistan, it was the women's issues and the women's oppression by the Taliban, who were, of course, a hardliner and a very conservative and with very harsh restrictions against women, had become an excuse to please the international and Western feminists and say, look, we are not going because we have a military interest there. We are going because the women are suffering there. So this is something that I clearly see it, and so is with many of my colleagues.
Arzala Ashraf Namat is a prominent women's rights activist based in Kabul. She spoke with Malihi Razazan. I am Lisa Detmer, and you are listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA Radio 94.1 FM.